is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Masella.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're heading into the traditional summer season of getaways. Days at the shore, kids heading off to camp. And we just want to remind our listeners, don't forget that sunscreen.
And not only do we see it in our clinics, but it's a national epidemic, skin cancer on the rise. There are over 5 million cases of non-melanoma skin cancers diagnosed in a given year, but the number of melanoma cases also on the rise, and that is a deadly form of skin cancer leading to over 10,000 deaths per year.
And as the nation ages, so does its skin. Margaret, an estimated 40 to 50% of Americans over 65 will eventually be diagnosed with skin cancer, a condition almost exclusively related to sun exposure, not just from tanning, but from ambient sun exposure throughout the day. So always use that sunscreen, but especially on those days with prolonged exposure.
And you know, the American Cancer Society notes that when used consistently, even a sunscreen of 15% SPF will greatly reduce your chances of developing skin cancer, though they do recommend a higher SPF, but any sunscreen and any prevention is better than none.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this country, we're focused on the summer holiday experience. There's a different kind of travel that's on our mind today, Margaret, and that's the 60 million refugees around the world who are fleeing violence or strife in their home country. The refugee crisis has reached epidemic proportions.
Mm-hmm. And the United Nations just sponsored the first World Humanitarian Summit to address this ongoing crisis. So many global agencies trying to assist those who fled violence and terrorism and poverty and instability, now living in refugee camps all across Europe, Africa, and some parts of the Middle East. And people would not have access to healthcare if it weren't for the amazing agencies and individuals that put themselves on the front line every day to do this care.
Absolutely. And our guest today was among that gathering.
Dr. Emmanuel Darcourt is the Senior Health Director for the International Rescue Committee. He has some amazing stories for us.
Lori Robertson will stop by. She's the Managing Editor of FactCheck.org. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love hearing from you. We'll get to our interview with Dr. Emmanuel Darcourt in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. 24 million, that's the number of Americans expected to lose health insurance coverage if the Affordable Care Act is repealed. In a study conducted by the Urban Institute, some 14.5 million children and adults would lose coverage under the Medicaid expansion program, which was expanded to include more uninsured Americans under the ACA, and just under 9 million would lose subsidized coverage. While the move would save over $900 billion in costs over a decade, there would be offsets to those savings, and states would also end up picking up much of the cost to cover their uninsured residents. In the wake of the most recent mass shooting, leaving 50 dead in Orlando, the question of gun violence as a public health hazard is back on the front burner. The American Medical Association is calling on Congress to end the 20-year ban on researching the impact of gun violence on public health. Gun violence leads to more than 33,000 deaths per year in this country. Dr. Stephen Stack, president of the American Medical Association, speaking at their annual convention, said Congress must act to repeal the act banning U.S. dollars for research of this deadly gun violence epidemic, which he says must be tackled as a public health threat. One issue that's often associated with gun violence, whether perpetrated against others or used in suicides, a daily occurrence among America's veteran population, is untreated mental illness. And telemedicine could be an approach to that prevalent issue. According to a study published in JAMA Internal Medicine, telemedicine could be a useful tool in a multi-pronged approach to helping veterans deal with the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, which affects just under 20% of the nation's veteran population. The study found having a nurse manage their cases, along with in-person talk therapy through a primary care provider and regular checkups via smartphone, yielded a good result for about a quarter of the patients in the study. And do you want to live longer? Well, the fountain of youth could be inside your church. Another study published in JAMA Internal Medicine showed that people who went to church generally lived longer. Researchers used data from a long-term study of more than 75,000 women tracking their health and lifestyles, including their attendance at religious services, over 16 years' time. After controlling for more than two dozen factors, they found that compared with those who never went to church, going more than once a week was associated with a 33% lower risk for death from any cause, and going less than once a week, a 13% reduced risk, as the church lady would say. Now, isn't that special? I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Emmanuel Darcour, Senior Health Director for the International Rescue Committee, a nonprofit global organization dedicated to helping those affected by the worst humanitarian crises around the world. Dr. Darcour began his global health career as a member of the Peace Corps, a pediatrician. Dr. Darcour has lived and served throughout much of sub-Saharan Africa and serves on the advisory committee at the Center for Global Health at Massachusetts General Hospital. He earned his master's in public health from Harvard, his medical degree from Johns Hopkins, and completed a pediatric residency at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Darcour, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, that's great. And what a just a tragedy out in the world. 60 million refugees living in camps, border enclaves, displaced across various countries, and you just returned from a major gathering of global health leaders, health experts at the World Health Assembly in Geneva. And what dominated this particular World Health gathering, and who were the participants, and what was the specific goal of the events in the face of this enormous humanitarian crisis?
Well, Mark, the situation in the world is terrifying and on a huge scale, but the focus of this event was really more inward-looking and trying to fix the shop before we went out and tried to fix the world. The main audience were governments, all of the governments who are part of the World Health Assembly, who in a way make up the World Health Organization, all had delegations that were represented, and they were the ones that discussed and approved policy. And then on the margins, you had groups like the IRC and others who are part of civil society who were trying to learn from this and to maybe influence the discussions. And the first focus was really on fixing the WHO itself, which a number of people, including those within WHO, have felt hasn't really performed as it should. So this may seem like a small ball or small scale, but people felt it was really important to first fix what was wrong with WHO before they would go and address the enormous problems facing the world.
Well, Emmanuel, I'd like for our listeners to talk about an issue that we are hearing more and more about, so concerning and heartbreaking, and that's the number of healthcare workers who've been targeted by violence in these areas of conflict. Close to 1,000 healthcare workers have been killed in just the past 2 years, obviously in direct violation of humanitarian laws. As somebody who lives and works and practices in the field providing healthcare in the most vulnerable places, what are your thoughts on this latest deadly trend, if you will, and what are you thinking about as strategies to try and curtail or stop it?
Well, unfortunately, it's very real, and it can be called almost more of a more than a trend. It's a massive phenomenon that's been going on for a while, but that I have some concerns, and we have some concerns about whether we're on the right track. Mm-hmm. On the one side, we're getting more reports about this, and there's a feeling that the WHO report probably is, on the low side. The problem, as we see it, is that the response seems to be outrage, and it's normal and appropriate to be outraged. But our concern is that outrage alone is not going to solve the problem.
Right.
That the people who are perpetuating these attacks are not being held accountable for what they're doing. And none of the reports and none of the current resolutions in the General Assembly or the Security Council are really going to address this impunity. So what we really need to do is to start putting teeth in those resolutions. And that's politically a very difficult thing to do. But until both the big fish, people at the heads of governments who are condoning the attacks on healthcare workers, and the small fish, the warlords and the soldiers who are looting health centers and killing health care workers, until both people at the top and the bottom are being held accountable, I'm worried that it's going to continue.
And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners the refugee experience, what it's like on a daily basis. Hard for many Americans to put our heads around the level of desperation that exists in for a family to risk everything, flee their home. Then they find themselves in refugee camps that seem to grow exponentially. I'm wondering if you can try to capture from your own vantage point the human experience and the toll it's been taking on the larger populations.
Well, Mark, you suggest there's really different kinds of refugee experience, and it's a little bit of a hurry-up-and-wait situation, mm-hmm. where on one hand, there's the acute situation where people are literally running for their lives with a constant sense of anxiety mm-hmm. and worry about survival. And those moments are unforgettable, but they don't often last that long. And then there's a different kind of experience, which is what happens when you are in a refugee camp. And increasingly, we have people staying in refugee camps for years and sometimes generations, where you know the people in the refugee camps have often an experience less of anxiety than boredom and mm-hmm. hopelessness. Mm-hmm. Refugees aren't allowed to work. But what it really means is they can't build a career, they can't gradually get promoted or become more skilled, and they can't really establish themselves, you know, by having a house, by providing for their families. And so that sense of boredom and hopelessness is, you know, in its own way as damaging as the anxiety and danger that marked the beginning of their refugee experience.
Well, Emmanuel, I think that at the same time, the scale of what you try and do is so massive in terms of the need for infrastructure, right? For food and shelter and education, as well as healthcare. And you've got the responsibility as the senior director of health for overseeing the care of millions of people. Maybe you could share with us some of the flat out logistical challenges you face where you have to have a stable infrastructure, but it's not there. Who are your partners in this endeavor? You certainly can't do this alone.
The overwhelming majority of the work that the IRC does is done by local people, for local people. Often when we look at the news and we hear about places like South Sudan or Somalia, the focus is on what they don't have, mm-hmm. Which is a lot. They don't have infrastructure. But the one thing that just about every place on Earth has is people. And for us, the key thing is understanding and taking full advantage of the vast wealth that exists in every country in terms of people. The reality is most people are actually intent on helping themselves and helping others. And we often go to places where there hasn't really been an opportunity for people to help, and they're actually very keen on doing so. A good example of this is in South Sudan, where there are indeed no clinics, there are no hospitals, but we find that equipped with very simple medicines, people who, such as women who don't know how to read or write, are actually extremely skilled at figuring out what the right medicine is. We give them very clear instructions, and giving basic treatment for children who are sick with malaria and pneumonia and diarrhea, diseases that are simple and easy to treat, but that can kill children. People who might have been seen as victims are actually our biggest allies in providing that aid. And we're taking advantage of that wealth is something that we do all over the world and that makes our work possible.
We're speaking today with Dr. Emmanuel Darcour, Senior Health Director for the International Rescue Committee, a nonprofit global organization dedicated to helping those affected by the worst humanitarian crisis around the world. We hear that there are a plethora of NGOs trying to do good work, but even with their best intentions, sometimes they're not able to achieve their ends. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your outcomes and evidence framework and perhaps share some of the tools you rely on at the IRC to ensure that the right care is delivered to the greatest number of people.
Sure, Mark. And, you know, good intentions are not enough. Good intentions can often not necessarily lead to good results. So we need to measure. We need to know what's actually being done, and we need to do so in ways that are somewhat independent and objective. There's a great sign on a Congolese border post between Congo and Rwanda that says, you know, trust doesn't mean that I can't check you. Mm-hmm. Yes, we can be glad of our mission and mm-hmm. we can trust an organization, but we need to actually see the data. So the outcomes and evidence framework is a way for us to clarify across a range of areas such as health, but also safety, education, power, and economic well-being, what exactly we're trying to achieve. You'd be astonished at how many times that mm-hmm. basic question hasn't been answered. Mm-hmm. And then once we know what we're trying to achieve, we're not trying to distribute food. We're trying to make sure that people have enough to eat. That then we need to figure out ways to measure this. Now, one common way we do it is through surveys. And that means going out and going into the population that we're trying to help and actually going house to house and checking what people have. And that has the benefit that it generates numbers. For mm-hmm. example, if we're giving out mosquito nets, we can measure what percentage of households actually have a mosquito net being mm-hmm. used as it should be. But it's also a way for us to learn all sorts of intangibles. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most valuable things I've found in my time in the field is doing home visits. And we don't always like what we hear, but mm-hmm. it's always very instructive.
I wonder, Emmanuel, if I could go back to our earlier conversation about the issues of hopelessness, maybe lack of purpose, and all that adds up to lost potential, particularly, I think, when we talk about children. And it's estimated that a child refugee could spend a dozen years in a camp before finding a permanent home. How do you build a bridge to the future? I know there's great efforts to provide education, but how do you build a bridge to the future? What are some of the programs that you've developed at the IRC that helps these families rebuild?
There are several programs that we have that look at the longer term, and often the crisis that cause the problem gets, you know, a few minutes of airtime, but mm-hmm. we realize that the disruption to the people we serve often is, as you said, for over a decade and sometimes generations. So the first thing we do, of course, is focus on education. You know, there's few things that replace a sound basic primary and even high school education, and we work on providing that in all sorts of contexts, in refugee camps, but also in places where people aren't even as lucky or lucky enough to actually get to a camp. The other thing that we do is we work on economic recovery and development. We help people to set themselves up in a way that they can generate income and also make choices about what to invest in. So increasingly, for example, we're looking at not just giving people blankets, but giving them cash so that they can, you know, make the right distinction between immediate needs, but also kind of building for the future. And our experience has been that when people have the option of getting cash, they often make very good decisions about balancing the short term for the long term. But another thing that we're doing, two other things at least, one is also looking at early childhood development. Learning how to read and learning basic math skills is important. Part of what can get disrupted in refugee camps and other settings is the basic bond between parents and children. So we work on those programs. And maybe the most important, we have refugees participate in activities at every turn so that they're people who are participating. And this really makes a difference for the future, as I saw most directly when I was working a lot in Sierra Leone. And there were people who had spent decades in refugee camps. And what those people reported, of course, was some sense of loss. They had gotten married much later than they intended and delayed starting a family. But they had also learned valuable skills. So a lot of the refugees in Guinea, for example, had learned French. A number of them had learned healthcare skills. So that experience for them of being in a refugee camp wasn't entirely a hopeless or passive one. It was also one of being involved in the work, so that often the people I worked with in Sierra Leone, the way they described it to me wasn't as recipients of the aid. They say they were employees of IRC because they had also been paid by IRC.
Wonderful.
To do work and trained.
Dr. Darkour, the CEO of IRC, David Miliband, was at the World Humanitarian Summit, a large gathering of world aid organizations seeking better ways to address the crisis. And he spoke eloquently, as you do, about the need to transform relief from humanitarian sector to humanitarian system. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the best practices that IRC is out there trying to promote. What types of systems do you deploy that should be scaled up?
One of the things that David Miliband looked at when he first came to the IRC, he made an effort to try to understand why NGOs acted a certain way, because he was familiar to some extent with the work of charities and NGOs. He, you know, I think was able to see some of the good things that were happening, the kind of more scientific work and the attempt to be more rigorous. But he quickly came to grips with things that were being done because we had been doing them that way for a long time. And that's a little bit what the humanitarian sector looked like to him. This is how we do things. And the distinction between a sector and a system is that a system is actually designed to accomplish something. And we need to figure out what that something is and make sure that we're actually accomplishing it, versus a sector that's just looks well-intentioned in our case. Now, there's several elements to how we're trying to reform the system, and key aspects are the outcomes and evidence framework that we talked about earlier. So what we're trying to do is to share our objectives with others, not unilaterally, but to arrive with other organizations at common objectives. And this may seem very humdrum, but it's becoming very real. In Sierra Leone, for example, recently, we've been working with a coalition of more than 20 organizations. And the idea is that instead of all of these different organizations all doing their own separate projects, which might be slightly different and each contribute something a little bit different, but miss other things, that we would all agree on the outcomes framework, meaning that what, for example, when it came to maternal health, what were the key elements to making sure that women did not die in pregnancy, mm-hmm. and making sure that between them, the different partners provided that. And what we found to our surprise, or maybe I should just say to my surprise, is that partners were very open to it, because I think it's a pretty widely shared frustration about lots of different people not quite adding up to be, you know, the sum of their parts, when really we should be more than the sum of our parts. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is be very transparent. We've just today put up on our website, information that's available to the public about what our outcomes are, what the evidence is. It's a work in progress, so we know that those outcomes and certainly the evidence will evolve with it, and we'll continue to share it. But the idea is that instead of, you know, just having IRC projects with IRC objectives, we have common outcomes that we share. It can seem like a tough sell, but David Miliband is an outstanding salesman, so I'm very hopeful.
Great. We've been speaking with Dr. Emmanuel Darkour, Senior Health Director for the International Rescue Committee, a nonprofit global organization dedicated to helping those affected by the worst humanitarian crises around the world. You can learn more about their work by going to rescue.org or follow them on Twitter at the IRC. Dr. Darkour, thank you so much for the work you do and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
My pleasure, Mark and Margaret. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good work and continued good luck.
Thank you very much.
And safety.
Yes, absolutely.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Donald Trump made misleading claims about California's drought and water issues. First, he suggested there is no drought in California because the state has, quote, plenty of water. But California indeed is in its fifth year of a severe hot drought, the kind that's expected to become more frequent with global warming. Trump also said water is being shoved out to sea to protect a 3-inch fish at the expense of farmers. but officials release fresh water from reservoirs primarily to prevent salt water from contaminating agricultural and urban water supplies. Trump made the claims at a rally in Fresno after meeting with farmers who told him, he says, that the preservation of fish species has caused the state's water issues. And the New York Times has reported that some farmers believe that. But experts told us water management practices, the state's natural climate, and global warming have all contributed to the state's current drought and water issues. The drought began in late 2011, and while California's climate is prone to long-term droughts, this one has been the driest since record-keeping began in the late 1800s. That's according to the Public Policy Institute of California. And 2014 and 2015 were the warmest years on record in the state, making this what's called a hot drought. That affects the amount of snowpack in the Sierra Nevada mountains, which typically provides one-third of California's farms and cities with fresh water in the dry season. As for the 3-inch fish, that's likely the Delta smelt, which does require preservation by the state. But the Chinook salmon and other species with a loss of habitat also benefit from the release of fresh water from reservoirs. And that's not why the bulk of fresh water is released from reservoirs. Most of the water that is being flushed out to sea is needed to prevent salt water from infiltrating agricultural and urban water supplies. The infrastructure that was developed to deliver water to farmers in the Central Valley has itself disrupted the Delta's natural ability to flush salt water out to sea. That contributes to the need to release fresh water from reservoirs. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Tel Aviv computer scientist and developer Oded Ben-Dov has been coding since he was 6 years old, and he's always been interested in hacking systems to make them better. So when this young entrepreneur unveiled a hands-free gaming system on Israeli TV, a local quadriplegic in the viewing audience took notice and urged him to think about adapting this hands-free gaming system to help quadriplegics interact with their smartphones by using simple head movements. Ben-Dov couldn't resist the challenge from Giara Livna, who'd been paralyzed for 8 years following an accident.
And the guy on the call said, "Hello, my name is Giara. I can't move my hands or legs. Could you make me a smartphone I could use?" And that really caught my ear, caught my heart. It was a chance to apply all my techie knowledge towards a greater good.
The two have partnered together on the project, deciding to call the device Sesame Phone, as in open sesame.
So gradually and iteratively, we added more and more configuration parameters to the program. So someone could opt for big head movement or very small head movement. You could use our extended voice commands, or you could use the built-in Google dictation capability. We really try to make it as wide as possible for our audience.
They say the results for participants have been nothing short of miraculous. Ben-Dov says he has seen both children and adults formerly locked in by paralysis literally come alive.
It's so emotional, and every user uses it differently. Someone immediately called his wife. Children, you know, rush to the most popular game and play that.
The Sesame Phone now has hundreds of users around Israel, but they're gathering funding to make the smartphone software available around the world. And Ben-Dov says they've got bigger plans for developing this and other systems that are geared to assist the handicapped community.
We broadened our vision to, which is currently equality through technology. I feel there are a lot of technologies that can really be life-changing for some people, but no one necessarily is working in that direction. We're positioned well within the special needs space, and we can keep supporting and developing our current products, but use new technologies and offer a completely different product as we're exposed to more and more needs.
Sesame Phone's tagline is, "Touch is overrated." Sesame Phone, a simply devised, hands-free interface that allows the paralyzed and physically handicapped to interact with their world through their smartphones using simple head movements, allowing them a new level of independence and a new chance at self-driven social interaction. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.